This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, America, or whatever your time zone across this beautiful planet Earth. You are tuned in to the People Speak audio show with Steve Johnson. It's great to have your company here. It's great to be here. It's great to have you all tuning in. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. Anyone can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of PAL Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have our virtual radio room called the People Speak Radio Show, that anyone may join to participate in the show. We have a very, very special guest on our show tonight. I'm more excited than a sewer rat in the White House. He's an author of the best-selling book called The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for Domestic Conspiracy. He's a Professor Graham McQueen, founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show, Professor McQueen, sir.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show.
Awesome to have you. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you, Professor McQueen, sir, is how did you get started in putting together the book about the anthrax deception?
Well, I had been involved in the 9/11 issue for some years and had kept stumbling across information about the anthrax attacks, which I hope people remember. They came directly after 9/11. And I kept running into information where people would say, well, you know, the anthrax attacks were traced to an American laboratory, very, you know, closely guarded laboratory that serves the military and intelligence communities. So that's where the anthrax attacks came from. And I would scratch my head and say, really? Are you serious? They were traced? In other words, everybody knows this was an inside job? Isn't this kind of important? Why isn't this on the radio? Why isn't this in the newspaper? Because obviously if that was an inside job and it came directly after 9/11, that would tend to suggest they both were inside jobs. Well, I decided to check it out for myself because there's lots of gossip, there's lots of rumor on the internet. You know, maybe it would turn out to be wrong, or maybe it would turn out to be unconnected to the attacks of 9/11 that directly preceded it. So I just took a few months off. This was a few years ago. I just decided to clear my desk, take a few months away from everything else, and read everything I could about the anthrax attacks. And I discovered that, yes, it was true. The actual anthrax spores that were sent to people and that killed five people were traced to a domestic source. And this was acknowledged by Homeland Security and by the FBI and by almost everyone. And the more I looked into it, it seemed that it was obvious that it was directly connected to the 9/11 attacks. And I was puzzled that more people weren't paying attention to this. Here we were struggling and straining to show that the 9/11 attacks were an inside job when it had already been shown that the anthrax attacks were. So I gave a few talks on this, wrote a couple of short pieces, and people said they found it interesting. So eventually I said, look, McQueen, you have to face the music here. You don't want to do all the hard research to write this up, but you're going to have to. It looks like nobody else is going to take the exact angle that I wanted to take. So that's what I did. And I guess it took about a year to do the research and a year to write it up, and there we have it.
Was it the case that when you first started looking at it, the rabbit hole just got deeper and deeper? The more you looked into it, the more you started to uncover even bigger signs of a false flag. Is that not true to say that happened to you?
Yes, well, there are a couple of things that everybody knows about the anthrax attacks and a couple of things that weren't so widely known. So what was known was that they had come quickly after 9/11 and that they had been shown to have a domestic source. Originally, there had been talk about, you know, foreign Islamic extremists and so on. And pretty soon that story fell apart, and it was traced to a U.S. domestic source. That much everybody knew, that was admitted. But the things that weren't so clear and that I had to spend a lot of time on were, first of all, showing that the fallback position that the FBI had arrived at was clearly wrong. So the FBI had done a cover-up. They'd said, okay, came from a domestic source, but big deal. It was your standard lone nut. It was, you know, one guy in a laboratory, you know, by himself with no help, and he was kind of mentally unbalanced. And unfortunately, he took his own life just before we were about to charge him with the crime. Case closed. Well, the more I looked into that, the more I realized that was absurd. The poor guy probably had nothing. And we're talking about Bruce Ivins, Dr. Bruce Ivins here, an anthrax researcher. He probably had nothing to do with it at all. And even if he did, which is doubtful, this was clearly not something done by one person. This was done by a group of people, and they had very, very high contacts in the U.S. military-industrial complex, way up to the top of the executive. So that's the first thing. The second thing that wasn't widely known is that it was obviously connected to 9/11. And again, the FBI had worked very hard to dissociate the two so that, you know, they could say, well, okay, the anthrax attacks weren't done by Islamic extremists, but the 9/11 attacks about a week earlier were done by Islamic extremists. So somehow the FBI's story was Islamic extremists attacked the U.S. on September 11th, and a week later, somebody pretending to be Islamic extremist attacked, right? And well, of course, that's theoretically possible, but it also seems a little odd. And the more I looked into it, the more I saw it's not just odd, it's wrong. The same people did it. This was really one operation, which you could call the 9/11 anthrax operation.
So the anthrax was a continuance of the first attacks that we saw at the Pentagon and the WTC buildings, the fake Building 7 implosion that they brought down. Now, from one thing I learned from your book, very interestingly, that it wasn't just one lab that created the anthrax. Well, one lab created it, but another U.S. weapons lab actually weaponized it. Is that not true? Turned it into a higher grade of infectious spores?
Well, there's still a lot of controversy and a lot of confusion about where the spores came from. So I would prefer to say that they appear to have come from one of three, and the three are, you know, USAMRIID in Fort Detrick and Battelle Memorial Institute, and the third is Dugway Proving Ground. Battelle does a lot of work. It's a private organization, but does a lot of work for the CIA. Dugway Proving Ground, mainly associated with the Pentagon, but works very closely with Battelle. In fact, I'm not even sure we can call them two options here. Fort Detrick is a little bit separate. Now, formally, the FBI puts it in Fort Detrick, USAMRIID. I always forget what it stands for. United States Army Medical Institute of Infectious Diseases or something like that. That's where the FBI says it comes from, because that's where Bruce Ivins worked. I think it's very doubtful, actually, that it came from Fort Detrick. I think it came from either Battelle or Dugway Proving Ground, and that puts it, you know, squarely within the intelligence military complex. And I think that we can't really separate where the spores came from and who weaponized them. All we know is the stuff that was sent around was very sophisticated, especially the stuff that went to the two senators and in my mind was definitely weaponized. And of course, the implications are really huge here. If you asked most Americans today, you know, has anyone ever actually attacked Congress with a weapon of mass destruction? I'm guessing most people would say no. But in 2001, that's exactly what happened. At the time, weapon of mass destruction mainly was used to mean nuclear or biological or chemical. This was a biological weapon, and it was sent to two members of Congress. The whole of the Hart Senate building was polluted and had to be closed down for several months. Senators scattered. At one point, you know, a whole bunch of people had to flee town, and so on. So we're supposed to forget about all this. This is the thing, because it's a story which is actually the gateway. If you look into it, it's the gateway into 9/11 and into the whole phony war on terror. So naturally, we're told that we should forget about it. Nothing to see here, folks. You know, keep moving. And partly I wrote the book just to remind people that they shouldn't forget about it.
Now, a question about the two senators that got the anthrax in their mail. Do you believe that they were attempted to be well-stoned? When I say the word well-stoned, as in forced into pushing their legislation through that they wanted to push. I believe it was a Patriot Act at the time. They were stalling on that. And these were the two senators who were voting against it. Is that not true, that they were pressured somehow by this attack to pass the law?
Yeah, they were certainly pressured. But I'm sorry, I missed your first reference to Paul Wellstone. What did you say there?
Do you believe that they were attempted to be well-stoned, that this was an attack on them because they were...
Oh, I see, yeah. No, I mean, certainly they were put at risk of death. There's no question about this. The stuff was lethal, and it was addressed to them and sent to them. Were they actually... Was the intention to actually kill them? I doubt it. I think it's more likely that their secretaries would have opened it and that they would die or get ill. I think the people that did this didn't give a damn, really, who died. But they certainly wanted to scare the senators and anyone associated with them. Let's face it, the five people that died were just ordinary civilians who had nothing to do with this politically, but they just happened to inhale anthrax spores, and they're extremely deadly when they're inhaled. So anyway, to get back to your question about was this done to bully them into passing the Patriot Act, certainly it was. I detail this in the book. I mean, you know, Dick Cheney gives a deadline and says we want the Patriot Act passed by such and such. I think it was October 4th that he settled on as the date when he wanted Senate to pass it. And Senate didn't pass it on October 4th, largely because of two Democratic senators, Daschle and Leahy, were holding it up. So guess what? Within a couple of days, two letters were sent to precisely those senators, Daschle and Leahy, exactly the two guys who were holding things up. And these letters were mailed to them somewhere between, I don't have the exact dates in front of me, but somewhere between, I think, October 6th. And 9th, so just a couple of days after the missed deadline. You know, and actually in the book I trace this almost day by day. You can see the executive constantly trying to bully the legislature, Congress in other words, into passing this act. And Ashcroft, the attorney general, is saying, if you don't pass it and there's another attack, it'll be your fault. You have to pass it now. This is dangerous. And of course, Leahy and Daschle are basically on board. I mean, they were traumatized by 9/11 like everyone else. They accepted it as Islamic extremist. But they did have certain basic duties. They had to make sure it went through certain committees. And so they were holding it up, and it almost got them killed. So, yeah, I think for sure. I think the anthrax attacks were crucial to the passing of the Patriot Act. And, see, 9/11 was blow number one, and that traumatized people, and that's when this act was introduced quite quickly after this. Ashcroft said he wanted it passed in a week, which is astonishing, given how huge it was and how it infringed on people's rights. And he just kept bullying them and there were these astonishing warnings coming forth in mid to late September, like, oh, we may have a biological attack first. Oh, we could be hit by anthrax. And sure enough, folks, they were hit by anthrax. And this foreknowledge is actually one of the clear signals that these people knew it was coming.
Now, you said that the attacks on the senators were basically there to scare them. And I believe that's exactly what they did as well. But it wasn't just them that they scared. They scared the people. They scared America. They scared the whole nation. I remember Tom Ridge, the Homeland Security chief, advising people to go and buy duct tape. That's how scared people were. They were taping up the vents in their houses. I remember somebody died because they couldn't breathe from taping themselves up. Do you think that scaring the people like that was part of a psychological operation on the American people?
Absolutely. This is called the strategy of tension, and it was a very consciously used strategy for several decades in Europe. The United States, the CIA was implicated in that. And the strategy is to cause fear and shock in the population through attacks of various kinds, which you then blame on somebody else, in this case, Islamic extremists. And the strategy of tension typically is meant to target the population. In other words, not just the people who get killed or injured, but the whole of the domestic population is meant to be shocked and scared. And then their ability to think critically and to resist pressure goes down. They kind of seek comfort from daddy, you know, from the state. They give up their rights and so on. So when we look at 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, you're right. We see that the population of the United States as a whole was targeted here for fear, anxiety, and all the rest of it. But what I wanted to point out in the book is that 9/11 and the anthrax attacks also very carefully targeted the legislature. In other words, elected lawmakers in Congress were directly and physically intimidated. And directly after they were intimidated, they were made to, or they were encouraged to do two things. First of all, to approve attacking other countries. That happened on September 14th when a bill authorizing force was passed by Congress. And then in late October when the Patriot Act was passed, that was the internal part of it, when we give up their rights. These two movements, external and internal, are often linked. In times of war, when a population feels it's threatened, usually does two things. It gives approval to attack the external person or aggressor, and it also gives approval to have dissenters attacked inside the society. You know, they give up their rights. And I was intrigued to find during this research that a poll was taken on 9/11 itself. Allegedly, something like 7 out of 8 Americans were willing to go to war, and 2 out of 3 were willing to have some of their rights taken away. And I thought, well, that's amazing. So the 9/11 began these two effects right away, and the anthrax attacks continued them. This was a 1-2 punch kind of operation.
Right, gotcha. Now, having read your book, there is a very clear difference between the anthrax spores that Robert Stevens, the guy who actually died, there's a difference between the spores he got and the spores that were sent to the senators. Can you explain to the audience what the difference was in the types of material sent to these two separate people?
Well, I don't know what the significance of the difference is, but yes, they are different. They were both the same strain. It's called the Ames strain, and it was first isolated in the United States, and it's used mainly in laboratories in the United States. But the stuff that was sent out to the first group, including Bob Stevens, was relatively crude, whereas the stuff that went, for example, to Tom Daschle was highly sophisticated. You have to realize that anthrax spores they can cause disease in one of three ways. You can get it through, let's say, a wound in your skin. You get cutaneous anthrax. You can get it in your stomach if you eat something with anthrax, or you can inhale the spores. And it's this third one, pulmonary or inhalation anthrax, which is by far the more dangerous. And about 90% of people who contact the disease called anthrax in that way by inhaling it die. It's very, very deadly. And the stuff that was sent to Tom Daschle was modified in such a way that it was very breathable. Let's put it this way. It was floaty. It was almost like smoke. When the young woman in Daschle's office opened the envelope, it floated out like cigarette smoke and very quickly contaminated the whole building. Anthrax in its natural state does not do this. These spores were very small, very even in size, just the right size to be inhaled and to stay in and lodge in the lungs. They were treated to make them, they were aerosolized so that they would float. The whole building had to be closed and cleaned for several months. So that was really deadly stuff. And that's why I say it's clearly weaponized. It's a bioweapon.
Mm-hmm. And the level of sophistication to get it that nano size, the particular size that it was certainly something that could not have been done in a backyard shed. Is that not true?
That's right. The idea that Al-Qaeda, whoever they are, could have done that in some lab, because there was this talk about, oh, well, they had a little lab in Afghanistan and some guy with a BA in chemistry was supposedly running it. I mean, forget it. You know, no way. No way. Furthermore, it didn't have any of the signatures of Iraq's program. Iraq didn't have stuff that sophisticated, and they weaponized theirs differently. And of course, as we later learned, they had destroyed all theirs anyway years before. So,
that's right.
So all this early attempts to blame this on Al-Qaeda and Iraq had come to grief very quickly. By the end of 2001, that story had fallen apart. That was the story that was pushed very hard during October, just so your listeners know. The idea was that Al-Qaeda had delivered the letters, but, you know, put them in the mailbox, prepared them, but that they had got the actual anthrax spores from Iraq. And it was a beautifully designed operation in the sense that if you could actually convince Americans of that, then you would immediately have a pretext for invading those two countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. Unfortunately for the people telling that story, it was baloney. Neither Afghanistan nor Iraq had anything to do with it, and almost everybody knew that by the end of 2001.
Now, the interesting thing is, when this all broke and this story came out, I did my own research into who was being attacked and why through the anthrax, because that was right at the burgeoning 9/11 truth movement when it first started. Now, this guy, Robert Stevens, who died in October 2001, was the editor of the Sun newspaper. However, from my own research, there was an affiliate newspaper he was responsible for called the National Enquirer. And just prior to his death, he had personally authorized published pictures of the Bush twins, Barbara and Jenna, pictures of them drunk and falling over. Do you consider there was a connection between the personal affrontage that the Bush family took against the editor, Bob Stevens?
I just don't know. I'm aware of these allegations, and it's certainly possible. I don't rule it out. I don't go into it in my book simply because I don't know how to corroborate that. I don't know how to verify that.
Right.
It's true. It's true. Robert Stevens was a photo editor. He was associated with those photographs. It could have angered the Bush family. We can't rule that out. But in my book, I just decided, you know, I'm not going to go there because I'm only going to look at the evidence that I can really corroborate.
Oh, the stuff that you can actually prove and say without doubt.
Well, with as little doubt as possible. I mean, we're often working with some degree of doubt, but we do our best to ground our speculation and our guesses in the evidence. And I thought about that a lot, but I decided not to go there with that one because I really didn't know what to do with it. It could be true, because if it's not that, then the Bob Stevens, you know, it's not clear why he was targeted. On the other hand, if you've read the book, you know that he was part of a web of personal connections that tied into the so-called 19 hijackers. You know, that he was actually, I mean, his real estate agent, if you like, was a woman who was directly associated with several of 19 hijackers. And this is one of the great important connections between the anthrax attacks and the 9/11 attacks. By the way, I don't believe these so-called hijackers hijacked anything, but I call them the hijackers in quotation marks here. You know the guys I mean, Muhammad Atta and the rest of them.
Yes, sir, according to the official fairy tale version.
Yes.
Okay, well, this is the People Who Speak radio show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson. We're talking tonight with very special guest, Professor Graham McQueen, live on internet radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Bowser. This is the great BBS Radio.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
You're listening to the People Who Speak radio show with very special guest tonight, Professor Graham McQueen. He's a founding director for the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, and he's the author of a best-selling book called The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. Please do search for that on Amazon and read it. It will certainly wake you up to what really happened back then and maybe even refresh your memory to some of the facts. Including the facts that the anthrax itself was developed domestically in the United States. Welcome back there, Professor Graham McQueen, sir.
Thank you. Great to talk.
Now, we have a couple of questions from the audience, but before we get to that, I would like to know personally, why did you go so lightly on Jerome Hauer? He was the Center for emergency management under Rudy Giuliani's team, and he was also, if I mistake, please correct me if I'm wrong, he also warned the White House a couple of weeks before to start taking Cipro. Is that not true?
It may be true. I've certainly read the allegation that he was the one that advised the White House to go on Cipro probably on September 11th itself. They certainly went on Cipro. And just so your listeners understand what we're talking about, Cipro is a powerful antibiotic. It was the antibiotic that was most recommended at the time, either against the anthrax disease if you had already contracted it, or as a way of preventing yourself from developing it. And so it was a little bit odd when we all discovered that George Bush and Dick Cheney had been put on Cipro on 9/11 itself, and anthrax letters were sent out into the mail a week later. It's kind of weird. It's kind of, you know, odd. But anyway, yes, the word is that I've heard that Hauer was the one that advised them. I was not able to verify that, but that would certainly be important. So I'd be happy to see any evidence that he was the guy. Certainly, he was in a position to do that. He had a degree from Johns Hopkins University, and he was considered a specialist in biological warfare, among other things. And it would make sense that he was involved in that.
Well, I was certainly very, very glad to see his name mentioned in your book, because any 9/11 study that doesn't mention him is not a fully researched paper, I believe.
Oh, yeah. He's a very suspect character. I didn't say much about him, but I hope what I did say was enough to make people kind of wake up to the fact that this is a crucial guy. I mean, he was, and again, he's a link. He's another linking figure because he links the anthrax attacks and the 9/11 attacks. He was also crucial in 9/11. He was the guy, one of the guys that, you know, convinced Giuliani to set up this, what do they call it, emergency management place in Building 7. Hauer was obsessed with building collapse. New York Times had this fascinating article on him a few years before 9/11 saying this is a guy who's obsessed with death and destruction and with building collapses. He goes around everywhere he can getting remnants of building collapses. And this turns out to be the guy who creates this Office of Emergency Management in Building 7. And on 9/11, Building 7 collapses, the most staggering collapse in modern history, not hit by a plane, 47-foot tall, 47-story steel frame skyscraper comes down at free fall acceleration. I mean that really is the smoking gun, and Hauer is directly involved in that. So when we find him also involved in the anthrax stuff as Mr. Bioweapons, you know, sure, he's a very suspect character.
Yeah, and there's even more connections than that. He's a connection to some of the investment houses, some of the big corporations that were in the building. He's a connection to John O'Neill getting his first day on the job on September 11. He was having dinner with him the night before in the WTC Towers, apparently.
Interesting. Okay, that's interesting. I either didn't know that or forgot that, so thank you.
I'll see if I can send you some information about that. Now, we have a question. Sure. Yeah, we have a question from one of the guest audience. Winston Smith in Vermont wants to know, is it true that anthrax spores fall to the floor and don't migrate readily? The cleanup of the entire building, was that an overreaction?
Well, we have to distinguish anthrax spores in their natural state from the anthrax spores that came to Tom Daschle. No, I don't think it was an overreaction to clean up the Hart building at great length. As Tom Daschle says himself in his autobiography, researchers were staggered to discover that not only were these particular spores aerosolized so that they would float around, but they also readily re-aerosolized. In other words, once they settled somewhere, they readily took to the air again, which they don't, apparently, in their natural state. They tend to stick to each other and to surfaces. So this is another case where they appeared to have undergone what's called microencapsulation. In other words, they had a layer of stuff added to them, which made them less sticky, if I might put it that way, and led them to bounce off surfaces and to float around in the air. And it was discovered quite readily that there were people from all over the building who were carrying this stuff around in their clothes, and that they had migrated to different floors of the building and so on. So in this case, no, I don't think it was an overreaction. I think that a bioweapon was used, and this is how it had to be dealt with.
We have a question here from Buzzy Krongard in Langley, Virginia. Professor Graham, is the term conspiracy theorist losing its pejorative effect?
Well, I'd love to know who this caller really is, whether this is the genuine Buzzy or somebody else. The term conspiracy theorist is normally used in a very, very loose way as a pejorative term to stigmatize people like me and like you, Steve. You know, we can be disregarded because we're conspiracy theorists. Is it losing its pejorative sense? Oh, I doubt it. I think it's been a very successful propaganda term. Now, when it came time for me to choose a title for my anthrax book, I used the subtitle in the end, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, and a lot of people said, oh, don't use the term conspiracy. Everybody calls us a conspiracy theorist. Nobody will read the book. They'll just make fun of it. And I thought of that, and of course they may be right, but I decided this is a term we can't run away from. I mean, this is not a term that's going away. This is a term that has an actual meaning, and it exists in legal codes all over the world, you know, like conspiracy to commit fraud, conspiracy to commit murder, all these things. So we don't run away from it. What we do is we stop, we define it, we say this is what the term means. I'm going to use conspiracy to mean this. I'm going to use conspiracy theory, the term, to mean this. And I'm going to put it in my title because that's exactly what I mean. When I say the case for a domestic conspiracy, in this case, it means that the FBI is wrong. The crime was not committed by a lone wolf. It was committed by a group of people because the term conspiracy implies several people. And so I spent time in the introduction of my book defining all this stuff and explaining what I meant. But no, I don't think the term conspiracy theorist has lost its pejorative sense, but I think we all need to confront people when they use it on us, especially if people say we're conspiracy theorists in respect to 9/11. We have to say, just a moment, a conspiracy is a plan by two or more people made in secret to commit a crime or an immoral act. Now, everybody agrees that 9/11 was the result of a conspiracy. That is, there were two or more people. It couldn't have been done by one person. They made a plan. They made the plan in secret, and they committed a crime. Therefore, it's a result of a conspiracy. Therefore, if a conspiracy theory is simply a theory that involves a conspiracy, everybody has a conspiracy theory about 9/11. You know, we have to explain this. The term conspiracy theory is misused all the time, especially with respect to 9/11, and we need to clarify this. So if somebody calls me a conspiracy theorist, I just pause and stop, explain the term, and go on from there.
Fantastic answer there, sir. Now, we do have a call-in question from a listener. Are you there, Mike?
Yes, hello.
Where are you from, Mike, and what's your question?
My name is Mike in California, and I have a question. Ever since supposedly 19 Muslim extremists, up to the point here where we have ISIS, ISIL connected with Islam, can Dr. McQueen, as an expert in comparative religion, explain the difference between Islam and what is perceived as extreme Muslim extremists? You know, I mean, you never hear the word Muslim in connection with a Muslim doctor or a Muslim teacher these days. It's always a Muslim extremist. And it has pretty much been used, I think, as a propaganda tool, and to the detriment of people who are, you know, there's supposedly 1 billion Muslims throughout the world. You know, they all can't be extremists like that. But yet that seems to be what the projection is, that that religion is a source of threat to the civilized world.
Yes. Well, basically, I agree with you completely. I think the war on terror is a fraudulent thing. It's what peace researchers sometimes call a global conflict framework. I mean, the Cold War was similar. It was a global conflict framework, meaning it was a framework within which everyone was supposed to be involved one way or another in this conflict. You couldn't avoid it. You either had to be on the side of the West, so-called, led by the U.S., or you had to be on the side of the Soviet Union and in this terribly dangerous nuclear arms race. You weren't allowed to be neutral. And I call it global because everyone in the world was supposed to be enlisted in this, couldn't avoid it. And when that began to disintegrate, and by the way, as you know, it's being reinvigorated now. Russia is once again the enemy. But when it kind of de-escalated, Immediately, another global conflict framework was erected, and that's the global war on terror. And again, Bush said, you're either for us or against us. So everybody in the world, every nation in the world.
Dr. McQueen, as an expert in comparative religion, can you tell me what specifically about the supposed extremists that differs from the genuine Islam? Are they promised 19 virgins? Are the actions and practices of ISIS, ISIL, have anything to do with the practice of Islam? I'd like the specifics, because most people equate them together. You know, they think of Muslim equated with terrorist actions and teachings.
Yeah, actually, I was getting there, but I'm happy to go directly to it if you like. No, the great majority of Muslims in the world condemn these actions of ISIS and of so-called Al-Qaeda. Certainly they do. I have lots of Muslim friends. They're appalled by this. Look at the polls. Most Muslims in North America are appalled by what ISIS does. This is not standard or orthodox Islam. Most Muslims think it is completely against the Quran and against Islamic law, against Sharia, to go out, you know, beheading civilians and doing these outrageous things. So, no, absolutely, it's not standard orthodox Islam. And yes, Muslims are being demonized. This is what I was trying to get to. Mm-hmm. I was saying the global war on terror is a global conflict framework in which Muslims are demonized, just as communists were before. So now they are the killable. They are the enemy. And there are very few distinctions really made sometimes between extremists and others. So all Muslims are stigmatized. And you're right to say that, and we should certainly defend them and make these clarifications.
Well, thanks very much for your question there, Mike.
Thank you.
Now, we have a question here from Rage in Virginia, who wants to know, do you believe in the space beam weapon theory postulated by Dr. Judy Woods? Do you believe that space beams could have taken down the Twin Towers?
No, I haven't seen any evidence of that. And, you know, if someone can show me some evidence, then that's fine. But I don't think we need to go to quite such an exotic explanation for the disintegration of the towers. I suspect that a combination of the relatively exotic military-grade nanothermite found in the dust and various more conventional explosives can probably explain it. And I never go for a more exotic hypothesis than is necessary.
So it was within their capabilities and to physically bring these towers down using conventional technology.
Well, yeah, it depends what you mean by conventional. It certainly wasn't a conventional demolition. After all, this was a black operation. It wasn't meant to look. Everyone was supposed to think that the planes brought the buildings down. That's why they would have tried to disguise the sounds of explosions and so on and so forth. But yes, I think that they had certainly had the means to bring these buildings down without resorting to so-called space weapons.
So beyond all doubt, definitely 9/11 was a false flag. The anthrax attacks were a false flag. Would you go so far as to say the Boston bombings, the Sandy Hook shootings, the shooting we saw recently of the journalist, would you say these have also been state-sponsored false flag events?
I'm sorry, what was your latest case, the shooting where?
Oh, there was a journalist and the cameraman that was shot by a disgruntled journalist.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, well, no, I haven't looked into that one at all, and I haven't looked very deeply into Sandy Hook. I find Sandy Hook intriguing, but I never speak out publicly on something if I feel I'm on weak ground. So I don't talk about Sandy Hook. I just don't know it well enough. I do believe the Boston Marathon bombing was a fraud, and I think there are a whole series of frauds in the global war on terror. I mean, I spent a good part of the last year researching one such attack that I have strong doubts about that took place in my own country, in Canada. We had a man with a loaded weapon who first killed a soldier in Ottawa and then managed to get into the building, the main parliament building in Ottawa, and run down the hall with a loaded rifle when the prime minister was a few feet away on one side and the official opposition on the other. It was amazing. It's called the greatest security breach in parliament in Canadian history. And, of course, directly after that incident, we had, predictably, a series of bills introduced by the government which restricted our rights. Very similar kind of scenario to the attacks in 2001 followed by the Patriot Act. So I've spent months looking into that, and I'm just about to put out a report on it. All of which is a way of saying I think that there is a long series of fraudulent false flag attacks in the global war on terror, but I don't speak about the ones I haven't looked into. So I haven't looked into Sandy Hook and the recent shooting.
Right, right. Understood. Now, we do have a question here from James in Omaha. What are the chances of getting the anthrax and 9/11 evidence into a court of law in either Canada, the USA, or both?
Well, that's a very good question, and I wish I had a good answer. I'm trying to do that. I've been trying to do that in a way, I suppose indirectly, for several years. And when on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings. So we had, I guess it was 5 days, I think it was full 5 days of testimony in Toronto, flew in people from all over the place to speak about 9/11, and then published it as a book. Now, that wasn't an official court proceeding, but we called it hearings because we wanted it to be a step toward a more formal set of hearings or a court case of some sort. And I've been working off and on with others since then to try and get to that next step, but it's difficult. The courts are compromised. They have been corrupted. So I know lawyers who have tried to bring it to court, both internationally and in the U.S., and have failed to get anywhere because, you know, the deck's stacked against us. So it remains a challenge. We're continuing to think about it. There'll probably be some initiatives coming up. What I've thought about lately is a slightly different approach, and that is to go for something that might initially be a little simpler. You probably know that there is most of the terrorism cases, the great majority of terrorism cases that come to the courts in both the U.S. and Canada are essentially police operations. The FBI, in the case of the U.S., the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, in the case of Canada, they either infiltrate or actively construct, you know, these terrorists and then, you know, entrap them in an act of terrorism and then get them thrown in jail. And in the U.S. case, there's a huge number of these. You can read about it in Trevor Aronson's book, which is called The Terror Factory. And, you know, he went and studied something like 508 cases in the U.S. Mm. So I think this might actually be an easier entrance into the court system. These are already coming up regularly right in the courts. And I think what we need to do is not only start winning a few of these by showing that the police are entrapping people and that they cannot be found guilty, or we need to go a step further and be very assertive and actually bring charges against the police for aiding and abetting. In the U.S., this would be aiding and abetting in the commission of a felony. And that's what they're doing, right? Mm. I mean, they typically provide these pseudo-terrorists, usually losers and people on the margins of society. They get them pumped up for jihad. They supply them with weapons, usually disabled weapons, but not always. They give them money. They give them emotional support. They become their friends. They give them ideas. They often lead the entire operation, the FBI moles. And it seems to me this is clearly not just entrapment, it's aiding and abetting, and they should be charged for this. And I think this might actually be an easier way to get into the court system, and I encourage people to do this.
We do have a question here from Rob in Hawaii, who says, who asks, do controlled oppositions like Judy Woods cause 9/11 truthers credibility problems and give the establishment cover, or is she just working for the government?
I truly don't know. I don't like to accuse people of being, you know, working for the government or something if I don't have good evidence of it. So I don't know whether Judy Wood is working for somebody or whether she's honestly doing her best and is just off track. Either way, I think she's off track, but I just don't know the answer to that. And so I'm going to have to be agnostic on that.
But do you believe she's causing credibility problems for 9/11 truthers?
Yeah, and I don't think she's the only one. I think there are lots of people who cause credibility for the movement. Every time I go to a conference or something, I end up rolling my eyes at some of the views that are being expressed. And I often don't know, is this just somebody who's deeply misled, or is this somebody who's been planted here to cause us a loss of credibility? Somebody is coming in and saying, the Jews are the problem, the Jews are the problem, you know, without making any of the distinction. What are you talking about? Are you criticizing Israel, which is perfectly legitimate, or are you accusing all Jews? Well, some of them are doing the latter, and I think a lot of that is planted. I think that just as we're called conspiracy theorists, they love to call us anti-Semitic. Well, and I think we... Go ahead.
No, sorry. I wanted you to finish there, but I do have a very poignant question before you continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
In all your evidence, did you find Israeli sympathizers, supporters, and or dual citizen Israelis were at the center of 9/11 and these false flags? I mean, isn't that the issue, that there certainly were a lot of Zionists and Israeli people involved?
Yes, there are. But that's not at all the same as blaming all Jews. The distinction is very important. And that's one I insist upon. For one thing, there are prominent neocons who I think were in this operation up to their eyeballs who are not Jews. And that includes Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and a whole bunch of other people. So it doesn't help really to accuse Jews. Furthermore, not all Jews are neocons. Most Jews had absolutely no knowledge of this. They weren't involved in this.
Absolutely.
So if you want to say Zionism is a problem, Zionism, after all, is a historical movement. It's a set of ideologies. It's not at all the same as Judaism. Then I don't have a problem with that, except if you're going to accuse Zionists, you need to explain to people what you mean by that. My impression is that many North Americans don't have a clue what Zionism means. Many of them think it's kind of a nasty word for Judaism. And that if you criticize Zionism and Zionists, you're anti-Semitic. We have to be very careful and very clear about what we're doing so people will understand exactly who we're going after.
Well, we've got a final question for you, sir, before we wrap it up here. Do you support the stop funding of Israel?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Israel is out of control. It's a very dangerous country. I think what it's doing to Palestinians probably qualifies as genocide. And I've talked to two formerly high-ranking members of the UN, intimately familiar with the laws about genocide, who agree with that. So I think to stop funding Israel is important, and for most of us at our level of society, we should support the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Absolutely.
To put pressure on Israel.
And what they're doing to the United States, let's not forget to mention that. They've certainly infiltrated our governments and our systems.
Well, that too.
Well, thank you very much for your time. You've been listening to the People Speak Radio Show with Professor Graham McQueen. I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to read his book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. You want to catch up on what really happened in the anthrax? Check that book out, or indeed find out a little bit more about the information that you were never told by the mainstream media. So thanks so much for being on the show today, Professor McQueen.
Thank you so much for having me on. You do a really good interview.
Well, I think we'll have to get you again. I certainly do have more questions. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on those topics. Thank you again, sir.
Okay, all the best.
Join us upcoming soon on the People Speak Radio Show when I talk with author Rebecca Roth about her new book, Methodical Deceptions, and with author from Australia, Auntie Kate Howarth, about the Stolen Generation. Stay tuned for those interviews coming soon. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike, Donald, and Doug, and to all my friends throughout the world and all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land from Canada.